After more than a year of deadlock, a major trade deal is now expected to win approval from Congress. This hour, what that might mean for Iowa. Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Before that conversation with Amy Mayer, political scientist Chris Larimer on how Iowa's congressional delegation is reacting to the impeachment process, a conversation with the Minister of Iowa Beer, Jay Wilson, about lobbying in Washington, Amazon puts down roots in Iowa City, and what to do about thieves who steal packages, so-called porch pirates. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, impeachment, the big story this week, the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. House. Now moving toward the expected party line approval of two articles of impeachment, which will send the charges to the full House for a vote. Let's get analysis from Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
Okay, Democratic leaders this week formally calling for Donald Trump's removal from office. These articles accuse the president of corruptly soliciting Ukraine to assist his reelection campaign, also obstructing Congress by stonewalling this impeachment inquiry. We want to focus this discussion on how our individual members of the congressional delegation from Iowa, the six members, four from the House, two, very importantly, from the Senate, are reacting to this week's news of the articles of impeachment. How are they reacting?
Well, I think so far we're seeing, we haven't seen anything, I guess, that would suggest that they will not vote along party lines. And so I don't expect any surprises there. I think what's going to be interesting going forward is once the votes are cast, the extent to which those votes are discussed when they're back meeting with constituents, when they're in town hall meetings, and how each of these members tries to perhaps frame that vote. So, I don't expect surprises on the vote. I think, like I said, what's going to be interesting is how it's talked about after the vote. Because for each one of these members, there's a different electoral context going into 2020.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the two narratives that are just 180 degrees apart from each other, the Republicans say, how could you? This is purely partisan. What a charade. Mm-hmm. This is nowhere near the level you need to remove a sitting president from office. And the Democrats are saying, this is what our democracy is about. Without this, our democracy will be much worse now and into the future, right?
That's right. Both of them are painting two completely different pictures of the implications of the articles of impeachment, of the votes themselves. But again, going forward, it's going to be interesting to watch how different members from the Iowa delegation talk about these votes, because there aren't going to be surprises on the votes from what I understand. But each one of them faces, and in some cases, a very difficult reelection environment in 2020. And that's going to be important, particularly for some of these members who are coming from swing districts, or in the case of Senator Joni Ernst, the extent to which Iowa is still a swing state. That may influence how she talks about this vote and how often she discusses it with constituents.
Okay, let's start, since impeachment, the process starts in the House. Let's start with our House members, our four districts here in Iowa. We have Representatives Finkenauer, first district, Lobsack in the second. He's retiring. Cindy Axne, also in her first term, like Finkenauer, in the third. And Steve King, the veteran, in the fourth. Let's go through those. What captures your attention in their reaction? Finkenauer and Axne, they're in their first terms, right?
Right. And that's really important to note, is that when you are going up for re-election, typically your first re-election bid is the most competitive. In the case of Congresswoman Finkenauer, Congresswoman Axne, they are from extremely competitive districts. Both of those districts at one time or another have been ranked among the top 10 most competitive in the entire country. If you look at, party registration in the 3rd Congressional District where Congresswoman Axne is, Democrats and Republicans are separated by about 2,000 voters. In the 1st Congressional District, there's more of a gap there between Democrats and Republicans, but that's also the district where you have the highest proportion of voters who are registered as no party. And in both those districts, you have that very distinct rural-urban divide. I mean, you can go back to the 2018 election with Congresswoman Axne. She won Polk County, but lost the other 15 counties in that district. With Congresswoman Finkenauer in the 1st Congressional District, again, it's a very much rural-urban divide where you have the Waterloo-Cedar Falls area, then Dubuque and Cedar Rapids. But outside of that, you have a very rural district and some very Republican parts of that district. So both congresswomen are going to have, you know, difficult re-election bids, I imagine, going into 2020. And what makes it even more difficult is that these congressional elections always get consumed by presidential politics. And now we're talking about the politics of impeachment, which is going to be make it even harder for each one of them individually to get out any message that's something other than impeachment.
Mm-hmm. We're going to hear clips from Senators Grassley and Ernst in just a moment, but we won't hear from our House representatives. What have Finkenauer and Axne been saying?
Well, there was a report on CNN just this week talking about how some of these, what they call more moderate members of the Democratic Party in the U.S. House of Representatives are perhaps, you know, having some trouble trying to, you know, how they're supposed to react to this or how they're going to talk about it with constituents and the extent to which there may be some concern that the articles of impeachment are overreaching, that there's a fear of backlash among voters, that perhaps voters are frustrated that they're focused too much on impeachment and not on getting some more concrete policy issues done. And in the article itself, they talk about approaching Congresswoman Finkenauer and asking for comment, and she did not comment at that time. And there are other reports where Congresswoman Axne is trying to focus more on policy issues. And I think that's the delicate balance for both of them is how do you talk about impeachment where that's certainly something that's very important to the base of the Democratic Party, but also talk about policy achievements. That's part of being a member of Congress. You know, you have that concern for re-election, but part of that is also credit taking. And typically you take credit for getting some sort of policy achievement done that's going to benefit your constituents. But if everything is being consumed by the impeachment, that makes it hard to do.
Right. And they'll be able to, both parties taking credit for USMCA and the progress that's been made there this week. Let's move over to the Senate. Let's listen to some, I got a clip from Senator Grassley. This is from Tuesday on the floor of the Senate. Senator Chuck Grassley voiced his views of the House Democrats' articles of impeachment. And Chris, let's listen to this, and I'd like you to then comment about what you hear in Grassley's narrative.
House Democrats announce they're moving to impeach President Trump for, their words, abuse of power. When all this started, Democrats said that the president committed a quid pro quo. But that didn't poll very well among the American people. At that point, the House Democrats switched to an accusation of bribery against the president. Now, maybe that didn't poll well either, or maybe they discovered that history doesn't support their definition. So finally, they've settled on abuse of power. It's kind of like a Goldilocks impeachment. The quid pro quo bowl was too cold, and the bribery bowl was too hot. But apparently, abuse of power tastes just right. Well, the American people are increasingly getting a bad taste in their mouth about the Democrats' partisan impeachment story.
Chris Larimer, what do we hear in this Goldilocks narrative?
Well, this is coming from, in the case of Senator Grassley, someone who has a lot more political leeway than someone who's going to be up for re-election in 2020. He's able to make a much more partisan statement than you might hear from other members of Congress. You know, the last part talking about Democratic voters and the extent to which they're concerned with this is interesting. There was a study recently coming out of UCLA asking about which issues Republican and Democratic voters view as most important. And what was interesting here was that both Democrats and Republicans view the issue of impeachment as being extremely important.
Hmm.
Now, obviously, they disagree on how they want that outcome to turn out. But both of them view the issue as very important. So, you know, we've heard a lot about that impeachment is distracting from getting other things done, which it certainly is. But both voters in both parties view this as a very important issue. But again, with Senator Grassley, he's speaking from a position where he doesn't have to worry about reelection. He can make a more part of what most people would perceive as a much more partisan statement than someone like Senator Joni Ernst, who's coming up for reelection in 2020.
All right. Well, you've queued that up perfectly because the next day, on Wednesday of this week, Senator Ernst spoke with reporters on a press call. She expressed her views on the evidence presented by House Democrats. And here, juxtapose this with what Senator Grassley said. And Chris, comment on the subtle or not so subtle things you hear in this excerpt.
I'll be honest, you know, what they have offered up as their articles of impeachment, I don't see any evidence that supports impeachment at this point. Now, maybe there's some rabbit in a hat that the Democrats are going to pull out during the trial, which, you know, might sway members. But what we've seen so far through their committees, it's a lot of secondhand, thirdhand, fourthhand. Oh, you know, this was overheard and that was overheard. Not actually based on the factual evidence. So I think the trial could be relatively short. I don't know that additional witnesses are necessary. I think it's important that we get right through this jury trial. I think that we need to get down to business. When I'm in Iowa, everybody is saying, oh, for heaven's sakes, get this over with and get your job done. And that is to be working for the people of Iowa. And it's really hard to get things like USMCA done, to get appropriations bills done, to get VAWA done, when we have the Democrats that are pulling these slick maneuvers. So I'm very focused on getting through the trial and moving on ahead with what Iowans want us to be focusing on, which isn't the trial.
Chris Larimer, what do you make of that characterization by our U.S. Senator Joni Ernst?
Well, that it comes across as a very different type of statement than the one we heard from Senator Grassley. You know, she starts off talking about just focusing on evidence, but she hedges a little bit there to allow for some room in case something would come up. And, you know, very quickly shifts to talking about specific policies. She mentions the trade deal that was discussed this week. She mentioned the Violence Against Women Act. She mentioned appropriations bills. So really trying to shift the focus away from impeachment and talking about policy, because, you know, what we know about U.S. Senate elections, in addition to being kind of consumed by presidential politics, part of that is based on the extent to which those members of the U.S. Senate who are up for re-election, their fate is often tied to the president. And so in this case, she shares party affiliation with a president in this case who is undergoing an impeachment process, who remains very popular with his own party, but not popular with Democrats or independents. And so she's trying to balance both of those things, is talking to, you know, thinking about the impeachment, what voters want to hear on the impeachment, but also trying to move on to policy things, because it may be the case when we get to November of 2020 that sharing party affiliation with the president is not a good thing.
We also heard there in that comment by Senator Ernst, she said not actually based on the factual evidence. I thought there was a general agreement about the factual evidence. It's the interpretation of whether this is high measures to high crimes and misdemeanors or not.
Well, I think what we've seen with this entire impeachment process is that this is what political scientists call hyperpartisanship, and it's on full display, because we are at the point now this past week with the House Judiciary Committee where we have lawyers come in who are on the Republican side, lawyers coming in on the Democratic side and give completely different stories. We hear legal scholars coming in who are invited by Democrats or invited by Republicans giving completely different interpretations of what the U.S. Constitution says on the issue of impeachment. And so, you know, what we've seen in opinion polls the last 5, 10, 15 years is this, you know, incredible divergence between Democrats and Republicans, where they think the other party has dangerous ideas for the country. And we're now seeing that on full display with, you know, members of Congress, with witnesses before congressional committees. And so I think that's just something that's playing out, where there doesn't seem to be any middle ground. There's no agreement on what facts are anymore.
Mm-hmm. Chris, before we say goodbye, give us an indication, give us a bearing on what we should be watching in the coming days and weeks.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I continue to watch for is whether or not there are any defections within the Republican Party. Something that goes back even to the 2016 election is that, you know, to what extent or what does it take for someone to leave their own in-group, right? And in this case, your partisan attachment. And so will we eventually see any elected members of Congress who are defecting from their party, and how many does it take to kind of create that windfall where there's some movement that would change the final outcome? Or are we just going to continue to see politics as usual in the sense that it's incredibly partisan, and this all plays out along partisan lines?
Okay. And of course, the big wild card here, will President Trump testify in the Senate? Will he be heard, be seen, right?
Right, right.
Okay. All yet to be determined. Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, Democratic lawmakers and the White House both claiming victory for changes made to NAFTA. This new agreement is known as USMCA. USMCA, a major North American trade deal, now expected to win approval from Congress. This comes after more than a year of deadlock. Let's check in with Amy Mayer, IPR's ag reporter, reporter for Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
Remind us, give us some background here, how this new agreement relates to NAFTA.
Well, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is 25 years old. So there are a lot of things that are very important in business and trade today that didn't even exist then. Things like digital technologies and intellectual property, changes in pharmaceuticals, advances. You can just imagine what life was like in 1994 and why we'd need an update to a trade deal. At the same time, there were certain contingencies that really liked NAFTA, others that had a lot of concerns about it. And so as the three countries grouped together to revisit it and come up with something for the sort of more modern age, there were a lot of issues to be hammered out.
Mm-hmm. And this was a big campaign promise of President Trump to get rid of NAFTA and get something better in it. And I guess from what we hear from Washington, both parties agreeing that this is a better agreement than NAFTA, though a lot of NAFTA is in here, as I understand. What is new, as you see it, Amy?
Well, a couple of things that are new are certain provisions around intellectual property, also things having to do with the digital economy. A lot of the agreement gets really into the details about where different pieces of an overall product are made or how information is traded or shared and what's happening in which of the countries at what point. And so I think there's a lot more detail in some of those aspects of it. And for the Midwest, some of the things that are more relevant have to do with farm workers, farm products, agricultural exports, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I know you have a lot of contact with the ag community, of course, but is this then, should it pass, as is expected to, a sigh of relief? Because farmers, the ag community has been under a lot of pressure, also due to the trade war with China. Is this a full sigh of relief? Half sigh of relief?
I think it will contribute to farmers feeling better going into 2020. One of the interesting reactions I saw is that the National Farmers Union Board voted just a majority. It wasn't a unanimous vote, but they did vote to support this new agreement. And the Farmers Union had been pretty critical of the existing NAFTA. But some of the things that contributed to that gridlock you referred to were labor resolution of grievances or disputes, labor conditions, and environmental concerns. Those were not specific to agriculture, but many of those overlapped with agricultural concerns. And the Farmers Union was, many members were satisfied that the deal that Democrats were able to broker with the U.S. trade negotiator, Robert Lighthizer, did work for what they wanted. So I would say it's a potentially going to have more broad support in the agricultural community than even NAFTA did, and NAFTA was generally pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. I see what I'm reading here. This agreement expected to increase U.S. agricultural exports by $2 billion, a $65 billion increase in GDP overall. So this is significant today.
It's important. One of the things that is different and quite specific is that it changes a little bit the arrangement with dairy products and how Canada manages its own dairy industry and what the U.S. can export. And so there's a hope that this will provide an increased market for U.S. dairy farmers who've really been struggling lately.
Mm-hmm. It's a deal that part of this agreement, it has to be reviewed after a certain number of years, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Do we know when this will actually be passed? I mean, we've got a lot of things going on in Washington, I've heard.
Right. I mean, people have been asking Senator Grassley this whole fall, is it going to get done in 2019? Will it get done in 2019? Grassley was hopeful as recently as last week that maybe it could, but it's pretty clear now that it'll be 2020 before the U.S. House and Senate have had a chance to finalize it and vote on it. And then also Canada's parliament, I believe, convenes at the end of January. So I don't think we're going to see a finalized deal probably until at least February. But at least I don't think any more of the terms are going to change. So unless something really blew up the whole thing, I think farmers are feeling pretty good about what this agreement's going to be moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Amy, before we go, let's talk about the other headache for farmers, especially the trade war with China. There's been some movement today on that front as well, being reported.
That's right. I mean, there was talk a couple months ago about this phase one deal, and then maybe that phase one deal had fallen apart. And now it seems that perhaps this phase one deal is in place. What's really significant about it happening today is that both countries had a timetable that called for increasing tariffs this Sunday. And now it seems that is not going to happen. So that should be a relief, not just in farm country, but also in retail land, because there was a lot of concern about what that would do to the Christmas shopping season.
Mm-hmm. Remind us a little bit when we talk about this long-going trade dispute with China. Remind us of how it sort of started and what the impact has been on the ag community in Iowa.
Well, again, one of the main things that instigated this trade war was intellectual property. China has been accused of stealing U.S. intellectual property, trade secrets. Also, there are some rules around how businesses can set up shop in China that the U.S. wasn't happy with. Unfortunately, because the battle relied upon these tit-for-tat tariffs, we saw a lot of farm products being exposed to these tariffs, resulting in China not importing as much as it had. So soybean sales, for example, had been gigantic to China, and China dropped most of their soybean sales. That hit our farmers here in Iowa really hard over the past almost 2 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and related to that, relating to commodity prices, when we talk not just beans but corn, we had the whole EPA thing about ethanol and the refineries receiving waivers on this too. So that's another impact on the farmers, right?
That's right. That's right. And it's worth noting too that Mexico is a major corn importer of U.S. corn. So this USMCA deal we were talking about provide some of that certainty back to farmers on the corn front. And obviously, improvements with the situation with China would be both for soybeans and corn as well, and ethanol, in fact.
Amy, what is the impact of all this on pork production here in Iowa?
Obviously, pork production is really important in Iowa. China is the world's largest pork producer, at least it historically had been. But pork did get slapped with some of those tariffs we talked about. Until this year, China was reducing its pork imports because of that, but they are having a terrible outbreak of African swine fever. It's decimating the hog herd there in China. So actually, China did start importing more pork. So the pork industry started to see a little relief from that trade war because of this devastating disease. Now, nobody's getting too excited about that because U.S. hog farmers really are terrified that the disease could come here. So they're not feeling particularly righteous or anything because they know they could be just as vulnerable.
Okay. Very important information. Also complicated. It's good to have you there. Amy Mayer, IPR's ag reporter, reporter for Harvest Public Media. Thank you, Amy Mayer.
You're welcome.
After a short break, a conversation with the Minister of Iowa Beer. Yes, there is such a person, Jay Wilson. We'll talk with him about his lobbying this week in our nation's capital in Washington, having to do with excise taxes, federal excise taxes on beer. Also, Amazon puts down roots in Iowa City. And what to do about thieves who steal packages? It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, of course, there's more than impeachment and international trade deals going on in Washington. There is legislation impacting the craft beer industry around the country and here in Iowa. The Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act of 2019 has been introduced in Congress. Jay Wilson has just returned from our nation's capital to try to talk with members of Congress. Wilson is the Minister of Beer at the Iowa Brewers Guild. That's a group, an association of craft brewers across the state. Jay Wilson, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Very quickly, just to make sure people know this is a real thing, you're the Minister of Beer at the Iowa Brewers Guild. The Iowa Brewers Guild represents all kinds of craft brewers from around the state, right?
Yeah, Minister of Iowa Beer is basically a fancy way of spelling executive director. But so if that gives you some kind of context, we just need to have cool job titles around here. We like to have fun in this industry, of course.
All right. Give us some background on this legislation. What is it about?
Yeah, so the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act is something that we've worked on for a number of years, and it got passed at the end of 2017, as you might recall, with a lot of other tax reform. It was at that time passed to sunset at the end of 2019, which is just coming up right around the corner. Basically, what it did for us was it recalibrated the excise taxes. They haven't been touched since, 40-some years ago when the beer industry landscape was very, very different. There were very few breweries that were very, very large. Now we have over 7,000 breweries that are all very, very tiny. Though there's media attention and people like to talk about beer and you see a lot of craft beer stuff around, like the fact is it's a lot of teeny tiny businesses. So basically cutting in half for all the small breweries across the country, the federal excise tax. So instead of paying $7 per barrel and a barrel being 31 gallons, it reduced it to $3.50 a barrel, and it freed up a lot of cash so people could expand, maybe buy a new fermenter, perhaps hire a new staff, et cetera, et cetera. So it was, a nice way for business owners to reinvest back into their business, but it was set to expire at the end of this year. So we're still trying to get it at least extended and perhaps made permanent.
Mm-hmm. So your mission in Congress, your mission in Washington consisted of what? What were you doing? Was it yesterday? Or the day before?
On Wednesday, there was a big reception, and I made it a point to go out and attend that. There were members of Congress that came to that reception. It was put on by the Brewers Association, which is our national trade organization. I work closely with those folks. And so I made it a point to attend that for the opportunity to speak with staffers and members that might be in attendance as well, is to just line up a few meetings and have some follow-up conversations. The mm-hmm. Iowa delegation has been really supportive all across. It's totally bipartisan. Doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. Most everybody likes beer. And so both sides of the story, they understand the small business element of it and have been very, wonderful in co-sponsoring in the past. So it's just a matter of trying to, at this point, have a few last-minute meetings to express the urgency of getting it passed. Otherwise, it goes away. We've had a lot of growth just in the last 2 years since that went into effect. In the last 2 years, I counted up the other day, and I think I'm right when I say we have 28 new breweries in the state just in the last 2 years.
That makes a total of total of how many breweries in Iowa?
Well, we celebrated number 100 back in September, and
wow.
Here we are basically 2 months later, and we're up to 105. So, really good growth. The interesting number is a full quarter of the breweries in the state of Iowa won't have existed prior to Kaboomtro, is what our shorthand for that Tax Reform Act is. A full quarter of the Iowa breweries won't have experienced that $7 excise tax before. And so it doubles for everybody on January 1 if nothing changes. But it'll be a huge surprise to the people that have just opened in the last year or two.
Mm-hmm. Over 100 breweries now in Iowa, a tremendous burgeoning of this craft brew industry. Beers being produced here in Iowa rather than imported from places like Milwaukee or St. Louis from the big breweries. Do we have an idea of how many jobs this has created in Iowa?
Well, we did an economic impact study back in 2015, and, a lot has changed since 2015. We're actually in the process of, we've got RFPs out with help from the good folks at the Iowa Wine and Beer Promotion Board. I actually serve on that board. So we're in the process of of pulling together a new 5 years later economic impact study. So I'd be afraid that I would tell you wrong on some very specific job number. So much has changed since that came out. But we'll have fresh numbers coming out hopefully this summer sometime.
Mm-hmm. Just to give you an idea, in Iowa City, I asked Big Grove Brewery, the big brewer in Iowa City, how many do you employ? And they put it at over 100 employees at one brewery. So it's significant.
Oh, it absolutely is. There's a number of breweries that are probably, you know, staffed in and around that realm. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are some part-time employees that are figured into that number. But, you know, then it goes all the way down to a very small mom-and-pop operation in a smaller community, and it's, you know, not a lot of staff. But, you know, it all adds up.
Right. So in the couple minutes we have remaining, who did you get to talk to? What members of Congress did you make contact with, them or their staffers? What was the response to your lobbying efforts?
On this trip out, I had specific meetings with staffers from Congresswoman Axne's office, as well as Senator Ernst's office. I've spoken with those folks in the past. They're good supporters. They're going to, you know, basically do everything they can to, you know, if it's Senator Ernst finding a way to help push the element with Senator Grassley, who's a key person really in this for us. That's one of the reasons why I went out there. Iowa is, interestingly, you know, in kind of a unique role, is somewhat important. Senator Grassley is the finance chair on the Senate side. So he's been working hard. I met with one of his staffers at the reception itself and had a nice follow-up conversation with them. They've been trying hard and on a bipartisan effort with the ranking member from the Democratic side. But we'll see what happens. I also had a chance to speak with Congresswoman Finkenhauer as well in person, and that was a nice conversation as well.
Okay, very quickly, two last things. What difference would this make to consumers, craft beer consumers in Iowa?
If it goes away?
Yep.
Well, it all just adds up. We could talk about tariffs for a while, but I have a feeling that's another conversation for another day.
Okay.
I don't expect that if it goes away, beer suddenly gets more expensive. Breweries will just stomach that cost. But there's a point at some point when tax after tax after tax things, you know, there is a cost adjustment on beer. I'm hopeful that it wouldn't affect it in any way like that. It just kind of hurts the brewers more specifically.
Mm-hmm. Jay Wilson, Minister of Beer, of Iowa Beer at the Iowa Brewers Guild. Hey, I have to ask before we go, you mentioned a reception this week on Wednesday in Washington, D.C. Did you bring any Iowa craft beer along to serve to those on the coast?
Iowa beers. Yeah, we did have Iowa beers. We had beers from Toppling Goliath and Decorah, and then we had beers from Single Speed over there in Waterloo and the Cedar Falls area. And I know that you need to know this. You Single Speed, and you guys did a beer called River to River. And so I got to drink River to River at the reception in Washington, D.C. I wanted to make sure to tell you that. I'm glad you asked.
All right. Now, you give us a lot of credit for this, but full disclosure, River to River beer, it's a German Pilsner made in Iowa, Single Speed in Waterloo and Cedar Falls, created by Single Speed Brewing there. It's the brainchild of the owner of that brewery, Dave Morgan, who donates a portion of sales revenue of River to River Beer to Iowa Public Radio. Just wanted to get that in. Wow, River to River Beer in Washington. Nice to know. Jay Wilson, Minister of Iowa Beer at the Iowa Brewers Guild. Thanks for giving us the details on your trip to Washington this week.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk about what you can do about thieves who steal packages, so-called porch pirates. But first, back in August, on this program, we discussed rumors that the e-commerce giant Amazon was eyeing Iowa City to put down more distribution routes. And those rumors seem to have some basis in fact. And in August, we spoke with Catherine Carlin. We'll speak with her again, business reporter at the Corridor Business Journal. Catherine, thank you for joining us with this update.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, back at the end of August, you told us Amazon was eyeing this former Procter & Gamble distribution center in Iowa City on the southeast side of town for a fulfillment center. What has happened since then?
Yeah, that's right. Last time we spoke, we had some fairly strong circumstantial evidence Amazon was on the way. But since then, they have signed a lease. on that former Procter & Gamble distribution center here in Iowa City. They are actively hiring permanent staff, and work is already underway according to the building permits that we pulled to repurpose it for last mile delivery station, which they are putting all over the country wherever there's a large enough population to justify it.
So, right, right. So, and this is a vast space, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's quite a bit larger than their normal last mile delivery stations. This is a 346,000 square foot facility. So it's kind of unclear now if they'll be using that entire building for this operation. We have heard that they might be using a portion of it for storage, but it is quite a bit larger than usual.
Mm-hmm. So what does this mean in terms of, well, let's talk about the jobs and then the distribution where Amazon's going here. But what does this mean for jobs in the corridor?
From what we've been told, this is just going to be about 20 permanent jobs. And those kind of range from shift assistants and managers to, you know, trainers, learning coordinators. But in terms of drivers, you know, there could be hundreds. I haven't had an actual number disclosed, but what I have heard is they're looking to hire as many as they can, because mm-hmm. this will probably be servicing a 50-mile radius, which includes the Cedar Rapids, Marion area as well.
Mm-hmm. You spoke with the Iowa City's Economic Development Coordinator. What else did you find out from her about this?
I have talked to a couple of economic development officials, and, you know, they have some interesting ideas, you know, in terms of what this could mean for the area. Obviously, they're excited to get a huge building repurposed. They're excited about the jobs. But what's kind of interesting is they're hoping to sort of join up some of the technological innovation that's going on at the University of Iowa with what Amazon's doing in the autonomous vehicle and drone delivery space. So in addition to plunking these delivery centers all over, they're investing heavily in drones and self-driving car technology to also automate their delivery infrastructure. So our economic development officials here are hoping there might be some potential partnerships with things like the UI's National Advanced Driving Simulator, its Operator Performance Laboratory. They're kind of hoping some of these synergies will enable some pilot programs with Amazon here, but I think this is just in the talking phase right now. Mm-hmm. But they're high hopes.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, not just Iowa City, but there are other locations in Iowa that where Amazon has plans and is building out, right?
Yes, absolutely. Since we spoke last, there's been a couple of other big Amazon Iowa stories to come out. The first one is the company is in the process of building a similar last-mile delivery station in Grimes. But what's probably the biggest news is it has also come out that they're planning a huge 780,000 square foot fulfillment center in Bondurant, also outside of Des Moines. And that's a very substantial project. It represents about $250 million in investment. It's expected to bring in about 1,100 jobs.
As you note in your reporting on this, Catherine, Amazon is on this big spending spree. To what end? What is the evolution of Amazon delivering to our doorsteps?
Well, I mean, essentially, they would like to control the entire process from beginning, from when you place your order to when it lands on your doorstep. So they have spent $800 million in each of the last two quarters. They plan to spend another $1.5 billion here in this fourth quarter, just building this operation out. And, you know, in addition to, you know, controlling the process and the customer experience, I'm assuming there will be a large cost savings on the back of all of the spending they're doing. And obviously, this puts them in a far better competitive position with bricks and mortar retailers when, you know, instead of, you know, going out in the cold to do your Christmas shopping, it's going to come tomorrow.
Right. Oh, so controlling the whole thing from, as you say, from the order until it arrives on the doorstep or in the mailbox, cutting out UPS, USPS, and FedEx?
Absolutely. That's the goal. And I think beyond that, they're looking into the future to automate this process and possibly cut out the workers as well. So it's going to be interesting to watch what happens with this.
Wow. Thanks for helping us make sense of this evolution. Catherine Carlin is business reporter at the Corridor Business Journal. Thanks for joining us again, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, finishing up our quick conversations on this Friday. In the age of Amazon, they're often called porch pirates, and Maybe they've raided your doorstep when you've ordered a package online to be delivered. Let's talk about this problem with Greg Bulow. He is a public information officer with the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Greg, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ben. Glad to be here.
How big of a problem has this become?
Well, as the holiday season approaches and we have some of the busiest shopping days upon us, many citizens, as you indicated, are going to have packages delivered to their homes. And so far, since November 1st, the Cedar Rapids Police Department has taken 7 reports of packages that have been stolen from the steps or the front of a house. And that actually is probably a small number of the actual package thefts or porch pirates, as they're called, incidents that have actually occurred in our city. We believe it's a very underreported crime.
Why would it be underreported?
Well, a lot of people don't even realize maybe that the package wasn't delivered until they find out, they get a shipping notification and that they don't see it at their front step. So a lot of them actually contact Amazon or the business themselves and say, I never got the package. Or they'll contact the shipping company directly, and they don't notify the police department that the theft actually occurred.
Of course, you could be mistaken, and it could have been Amazon's mess up, I suppose. I guess this raises a question, Greg, of when should you report? How do you know when you should report what you think is a missing package?
Well, it's a great question. What we recommend at the police department is that you always track your shipment online. Most shipping companies have some type of tracking service, which will give you status notifications or when the delivery will occur. And then what you'll want to do is, if that package was supposed to be there and it shows it was delivered, it's not there, then contact the shipping company directly to find out if indeed it was delivered. You can also contact the company. And then if it's gone, there's a good chance that it was stolen, and it's probably not a bad idea to go ahead and make a police report. And the reason we recommend people do that is if everybody just kind of dismisses it and gets another package redelivered to their house or gets a credit, whatever they end up doing to resolve the issue of not getting the items at their door, the police department, by having a report, will be able to pinpoint where all these thefts are occurring. And so we may have a certain area of our community in which a lot of them are occurring. We can do focused patrols or look at some surveillance footage that citizens may offer and hopefully apprehend the person or persons responsible.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the instances that you have had there in the Cedar Rapids area, what can you tell us about how these porch pirates operate, how they avoid being caught if they pick certain neighborhoods or certain types of deliveries?
Well, interestingly, out of the 7 reported package thefts that we had here in Cedar Rapids, 4 of the victims actually had surveillance video available. A lot of them have like the doorbell cameras or other kind of surveillance system on their house. Unfortunately, in 3 of the 4 cases, the video was of such poor quality, there was really no investigative value. You know, what you can maybe look at is a shape of someone or maybe the way they walked or if they had a certain gait, but that makes it very difficult. On one case, though, in particular, where the footage is very clear, and it doesn't cost a lot to upgrade and get more quality technology for these surveillance cameras, officers were able to actually detect, like, for example, the license plate of the vehicle that pulled up in the driveway. The suspect got out, grabbed it, and jumped right back in the car. So it happens very quickly, but the surveillance footage is invaluable when it captures something like that piece of information.
Greg Bulow, thank you so much. Public Information Officer with the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Thank you.
Yep, enjoy talking to you. Have a great holiday.
Hey, you too.
All that's left to do on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News is to groove into the weekend. We love to do that to mark the end of the week and get us into the weekend. Mark Simmet is with me, IPR Studio One host. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
What do you got to groove us into the weekend?
Well, you know, it's the holiday season, Ben.
I've noticed that.
And we are playing more and more holiday music, and we've gotten a pretty good quantity of new holiday music this year, which is really nice to see. And I thought I would play you something from the second album that bluesman Keb Moe has released in this calendar year. It is called Moonlight, Mistletoe, and You, and this is Better Every Day.
Hello, everybody. how you doing today? Can I pour you all a cup of coffee? I think I got something to say. Well, I ain't gonna worry about the money while I'm spending all my time. Well, I just wanna get up in the morning with the things on my mind.
Ooh, you're putting me right in the holiday spirit, out of the news junkie mindset. Mark Simmet, thank you so much. I think we'll go out with Keb Moe there. Thank you so much. Mark Simmet, remind us, how can we tune in for Studio One Tracks?
Well, you can hear Studio One Tracks 7 nights a week, 7 to 10 p.m. on Iowa Public Radio's Studio One stream, actually, at iowapublicradio.org, or we are also heard in our broadcast version, 7 to 10 p.m.
Mark Simmet, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Ben.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Also, thanks to Julia DiGiacomo. And our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go out with Keb Moe in the holiday spirit. This is Better Every Day. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tune in again Monday. I'm coming up to-